podcast, which somehow ends up being the second episode of the podcast, thanks to the magical Swadeshi concept of zero. We are recording this on 4th August India time. This is Vikram Mohan, producer and frequent interrupter of the podcast. Thanks for the overwhelming response to the podcast. I mean, I know the word is overused, but it's very apt here. So thank you so much. Now, the man who is too right-leaning for the left and too leftist for the right, but he is in the Goldilocks zone for the rest of us. And you're just right, Arnab Ray. Hi, Arnab. Welcome back. And your thoughts on the reception of episode zero.
So first of all, when somebody starts an episode from zero, you know that they have done coding in C. Okay. That means they know exactly from where the array starts. So this is a very geeky thing, and I'm very glad that we started from episode zero, which means you'll always have to remember to do a minus one. Otherwise, you'll have a buffer overflow. And this is a perfect segue into our first story today. So I think the reactions to the first episode were great. It wasn't like, the first show of Devanand's Mr. Prime Minister. So there was a sufficient amount of interest. Of course, there was some criticism. I think more than people saying it was a great thing, I'm more interested in the criticism because for two reasons. First of all, I've noted your names down, of course. And second is, I think persistent criticism was the show was too long, which there's nothing we can do about it. The second point was that somehow I come across better when I write than when I speak. Again, there's nothing I can do about that. I guess, I hope I'll get better. That was about it. That was about it. And some people felt that the jokes didn't land, that jokes land much better when they're written. Somehow, I guess I don't have the ability to talk through jokes or talk through humor on voice. And that might be true. I mean, I don't have a stand-up comedy background, so that might be a problem. But just to clarify, this podcast is not intended to be a funny podcast. I mean, this is really pretty serious. Of course, humor comes in naturally, but this is not a stand-up routine. So if you're listening to this expecting stand-up, this is not that. We will be discussing serious topics. And I mean, if you're discussing, the refugee problem in Assam, it's very difficult to, make fun of that or to get used to laughing on that topic. But we'll have some levity also, of course. So that's about it. I mean, I think we should go to the first topic at this point of time, right?
Yeah, and before we get to that, we also have a fun little game in this podcast called What Song? So sometime during the course of this podcast, you'll have to pay attention. You'll hear a small clip from a Bollywood song. So just tell us what the song is and the movie it's from. And you could win a copy of Mahabharata Murders or Sultan of Delhi, Yatrik, May I Have Your Attention Please, or Mine. I wonder what's common between these books. I must figure it out someday. You can mail us your response on appodcast@talkingstuff.net or tweet us at on Twitter at @talkingstuffnet. Of course, you can tweet the great Bong himself. So Arnab, back to you.
Sure. So the first story that I wanted to do today was something which broke today. It was originally not in my plan, but it was the realization in the morning. And this is the only topic on which I can say that I have a formal background in. Everything else that I talk about, I have absolutely no formal background in, but cybersecurity, I've done something. So this was news everywhere on social media that apparently Amit Shah has broken into Google and has put in a strange telephone number into all our telephones. Now, all our cell phones, suddenly there's a number which is shown up, which is the UIDAI's phone number. Now, when I first saw this, it was pervasive. People were saying, we just saw this number. We didn't put it in our SIM card. I mean, this is in an address book. When I first saw it, I was really surprised because in order for somebody to cross-platform, essentially compromise, that means the code has been compromised in some kind of way across all platforms, across all operating systems, which means that somehow the Indian government has gotten access to the signing keys, the code signing keys of Apple, Google, which, I mean, I'm not saying it's beyond the realms of possibility. I mean, conspiracy theorists always say that the NSA has these things, but there's no proof. But that the Indian government somehow has been able to, either through a zero-day vulnerability or some strange, and that's the thing, I couldn't figure out how they could have done it. has suddenly compromised all cell phones in India so that they have this hidden number. First of all, I couldn't understand why having a hidden number. I mean, if you're able to do this kind of exploit, why you would plant a phone number rather than doing other things? The only thing I could think of was, okay, you make a mistake and you send your nude pictures to this number. You text it. That's the only thing I could think of as to why the government would perhaps, or somebody in the government might want to put in a phone number in your cell phone. But then, of course, it was resolved. But before that, on WhatsApp groups and on my, like, I am on several WhatsApp groups with people who are extremely critical of Modi. I mean, they wake up in the morning and try to, they basically tweet the top, they basically in WhatsApp, they basically link to the top three stories of The Wire that day, every day. So they were, of course, aghast that, you know, Amit Shah has broken in. And then after some time, there was a clarification from Google that in 2014, based on a government circular, they put in this telephone number. Again, I don't know why they would want to do it, but Google did it. It was Google which did it. Obviously, it's some, you know, those of you who took the SIM cards and put it into an iPhone, then it was in your SIM card in iPhone. So that's why people saw it in iPhone also. But ultimately, the source of it was Google, and it was not something sinister. And this makes sense. I mean, the guys who made Aadhaar, the guys who coded Aadhaar, do not know the basics of cybersecurity. And for those people who don't know the basics of cyber defense to suddenly become masters of cyber offense, it just seemed too huge a bridge to cross. So that was why I was surprised. And really, so what's the real story behind this? The real story is that when you are talking about technology, I mean, in order to talk about Shamita Shetty and her problems with the BMW dealership, you don't need any background for that. I think all of us are experts on Shamita Shetty. But if you're going to talk about privacy, if you're going to talk about cybersecurity, and if you are in a position of power, and I'm talking to you, the Indian media, it's very important that you get qualified people to do these kinds of stories. Because what happens at the end is, it's never been resolved. Even though Google has come up with a statement, there are people who will say, but this is all a cover-up. Something must have happened. There is no smoke without a fire. I don't trust the government. I don't trust Aadhaar. I don't trust anything. And so that is the narrative. I don't trust Aadhaar. I don't trust the government. These are just the special effects. And I have no problem with special effects. I have no problem with people trying to delude themselves. But as a cybersecurity, you know, as somebody who studied cybersecurity, I would never call myself a cybersecurity expert because you can never be one. So as a student, and not a very good student also of cybersecurity, I would say, I just believe that the reportage on things like this should be more grounded in reality and more grounded in science. Right now, the coverage was mostly like homeopathy. That kind of sums up what I think about what happened today with the strange UIDAI number. So what we shall move on to what?
We'll talk about the match, of course. What's left of it?
Of course, we'll talk about the match. So right now, when this is being recorded, I have no idea. This is end of third day. Fourth day hasn't started. So I'm not, and this is one of the problems, I cannot criticize the Indian cricket team at this point of time. I have absolutely no idea what they're going to do tomorrow. I really do hope that that this does not become a repeat of Chennai. The reason why I was a little bit scared was because Nayan Mongia was the keeper.
Bad memories.
And he also batted somewhat like Dinesh Karthik is batting today. And somehow that Chennai match against Pakistan in 99 is just so burnt in to our psyche of all our 90s kids that whenever we see something similar, our mind immediately goes back and we start creating all these connections to that 99 test match against Chennai, which totally gutted us at the end. And kind of that was the end of, I would say, that shot that Sachin hit was officially the end of his legend. I mean, it's maybe premature to say it. I mean, he has still many years left. But that was the time in which people realized that he wasn't God. So that test match, I hope that Kohli does better. I believe this is a very different team than what it was in '90s. But sometimes it just becomes like '90s. And today was a day like this on the third day, where you had somebody like Ajinkya Rahane, who's, and I tweeted this, his test game has somehow gone to the dogs. His might be, and I'm very careful about saying these things, but somehow I think that IPL, and I don't blame IPL for a lot of things, but I think that that game that he's tried to make a permanent spot for himself in the one-day team, in the T20 team, it has kind of changed the way he bats. He throws his bat nowadays. So if you look at his first innings, there were multiple times when he tried to leave the ball, but the ball came and hit his bat. This is a very, very fundamental error in judgment for a test cricketer. If you're trying to leave the ball, and this didn't happen just once, this happened multiple times, it came and hit his bat. So this was, he was not only misjudging the line, he was also misjudging the bounce. And these are really the what separates a good test batsman from, let's say, Hardik Pandya. And we expect more from Ajinkya Rahane. And just seeing it, and he might prove me wrong in the next test if he gets a chance to bat. But I was most disappointed in his innings, in both the innings that I saw him. This was not the Ajinkya Rahane that I thought that I would see. With respect to Dhawan, he was exactly what I thought I would see. So I am sometimes surprised by the amount of faith that the team administration puts in David Dhawan. And here's my reason for that. It's not that Shikhar Dhawan is a bad opening batsman. He's a very good opening batsman in India. Because in India, we were expected to score 500, 550, 600 runs. He scores runs at a fair clip. If you just leave it to a Murali Vijay, he will take 3 days to score 100. And you can't win at that point of time, then it becomes a draw. So you need somebody like him who's very aggressive as an opener, but he's no Sehwag. The difference between him and Sehwag is Sehwag was a genuinely great batsman. I mean, his technique was actually very solid. Despite his aggression, he wasn't somebody who was technically weak. That's why he had such a stellar test career. And that too on foreign pitches. He's no Sehwag. So his aggression. So you sometimes carry a player like Sehwag who's a little bit of hit and miss. You say, okay, in the modern game, you know, the Sunil Gavaskar model of opener is no longer true. I mean, people don't expect one opener like that is fine. You need one solid opener, one aggressive opener. I get that. And so maybe that's the reason why he stays in the team. But his technical problems, especially on a pitch like this, where the ball is swinging, you know, the sky is overcast. This is a classic British pitch. This is the kind of pitch where somebody like him, he will be exposed. Tomorrow, I'd said this on Twitter, I sincerely hope that if Pandya comes to bat, Hardik Pandya comes to bat, which he possibly will, he just takes this like he's playing Mumbai Indians game and he'll not play more than 12 balls. Because in any case, he's not going to be able to play more than 12 balls. So he should try to maximize what, and the score is such that we are now at this point of time, we're down to 90 runs or something. So even if he can score 20, 25 runs, that will tilt the match at this point of time. The worst thing I believe that he could do, and I'm making a prediction, is try to battle it out, because he cannot, you know, his technique cannot last him through 3 or 4 overs of Anderson if the sky is overcast tomorrow. I mean, he just doesn't have it in him. I think, and I would like to make a point about Kohli's innings. So what really made that innings great was because of the imperfections in that innings. So if you look at the way Kohli played, he was dropped multiple times. Okay, his performance against Anderson was anything but convincing. Anderson probed him in exactly his weak spots and he almost succumbed to it. Now, this is where it is a test match. Test match doesn't necessarily, a great batsman isn't somebody who always dominates. There are limitations to even the greatest of batsmen. And it's obvious that Anderson is one of his limitations. But what was worth noting is how he stuck through it. What often happens to batsmen is that an experience like that, where they have no clue as to what the person is doing, that kind of affects them. And then they try to become over-aggressive on the other bowler. And that's when they lose their wicket. What was amazing about Kohli's innings was that he stuck through it. That's really the hallmark of playing test matches. That things might go wrong. There might be a session in which you're not being able to even see the ball. But you as a test batsman have to have confidence in yourself that I can see this session out. That bowler is going to tire. He can't keep on bowling like this. All I have to do is survive. See, because that survival phase is something which is not there in one day, which is not there in T20. That's the boring part. That's what they want to cut out. But for us who really love cricket, that is what makes a test match a test, where somebody is just trying to survive. And I think the greatest passages of play in this test match was when Kohli was just trying to survive. I sincerely hope they win tomorrow. At least it looks like this series we're not going to have a repeat of the last time we were in England when they were making 650. And even after they were getting out, Sachin Tendulkar was calling them back. So I think with Kohli, I think that's not going to happen. I think the bowling is great. Next test match, Pujara has to come back. Again, I don't know if Pujara would have made a difference, but at least he has been batting in these conditions. He's not had a great season with Yorkshire, but at least he's been batting in these conditions for a while now. I still think that Dhawan should not be playing. I mean, I don't know whether it should be Dhawan or Rahane. One of them should be dropped next test match. Rahul should be made the opener. And Pujara should be given his number.
So if, let's say, Paras Mambre and my namesake Vikram Rathore, if they were watching this test match, let's say sitting huddled together over chai or over drinks, what do you think their thoughts would be?
With Vikram Rathore, I mean, these guys don't... that's a good question. I mean, I think they would just be saying, good thing we're not batting there today. I think Vikram Rathore would be happy he's not batting. Vikram Rathore actually was an okay batsman. Paras Mambre, I would reserve my judgment on Paras Mambre. But Vikram Rathore was okay. I mean, again, the tragedy of these guys in the 90s was that they did not have the kind of support structure that our batsmen today have. I mean, the amount of money that has gone to make Dhawan what he is today, and the resources that he has, is nothing compared to what Vikram Rathore has. If Vikram Rathore had the resources that Dhawan had, it might have been a very different ballgame for India in the 90s. So let's see what happens. I think it was a great test match. I obviously love test matches in which are low scoring. You know, 250 is a winning total. I don't like 400, 500. You know, those are the things which really kill test matches. So I'm really happy about this test match. I think Karan's bowling was amazing. I hope for India's sake that he's like Ronnie Irani, that we'll never see him bowl like this ever again. But his performance today was very much like Mohammad Amir in his prime. So, you know, at 85 miles per hour, he's swinging the ball. He's bowling good Yorkers. He's batting like a champion. This was really, really, really an amazing, amazing debut. This is his first test, I believe. I'm not sure about that.
And great crowds too. I mean, first time in England, I'm seeing almost close to a full house for a test match.
Yeah, I think this is one of the things about this Indian side, in contrast to the side against whom Graham Good scored 300 runs, is that this is a team of fighters. I mean, Kohli, for good or for bad, he's an entertaining person even in the field, even when nothing's happening. So I think we bring this really overt aggression. Problem is, I think some of the players, their performance in this match, especially the batsmen, just doesn't match up to that aggression. But hopefully, it'll get better. What I'm afraid is, and I hope it doesn't happen tomorrow, is we end up losing this test, because this has happened to us so many times. We will definitely play better as the series goes on. That always happens. Our best test matches are usually the fourth and the fifth test match. If we are able to win this, there's a very good chance we'll be able to win this series. If we don't, I don't know. I don't know if India will be able to come back.
So, from the war on the cricket field to possibly a civil war, what's next?
So, see, the problem with refugees is it's one of the most contentious problems all over the world. So there is really no good solutions. And this is one of those topics in which it's not a good idea to be very absolute. We have to look at different aspects of the problem. I mean, this concerns people, and it concerns some of the most weakest and vulnerable people that we have in the world. I mean, nobody chooses to become a political refugee versus an economic refugee. I'm an economic refugee myself, but nobody volunteers to be a political refugee. So we have to be sensitive about this, even when we're speaking. But before we start on that, let's first get rid of the false arguments off the bat. So one of the arguments that I see is, what would happen if Trump did this to NRIs like us? Okay, first of all, this is not even a valid comparison because we are legal. Okay, so we have the papers. And trust me, for anybody who has ever been in the US, God, we have to go through multiple hoops every friggin' year to make sure that we are legal. Secondly, this would be a valid analogy if the Indian government had changed the rules. So many people said, well, what if Trump tomorrow says that all H-1Bs have to go home? Well, then he's changing the rules. Okay, he's changing the notion of legality. In this case, the notion of legality hasn't been changed. This is essentially a court-mandated activity, which has come to an end. And yes, as we all know, that there are a lot of people without papers. Now, I understand the point that many people might be legal and they might not have papers. But it's also true that many of them are illegal in the sense of the term, that they just came across the border. Now, of course, this false analogy comes in, and this kind of ties into the hatred many people have about NRIs. So, you know, whenever, because I'm an NRI, so this is the first thing that I hear. What will you do if they do this to you? First of all, they are doing it to many of us. So even as legal immigrants in the US, the waiting period for getting a green card, so basically for becoming a US citizen for Indian citizens, is now 150 years. I'm not making this up. It is 150 years for EB2. Now, this basically saying you are not going to become a green card holder. Right? I mean, this is basically refusing citizenship at this point of time. A waiting period of 150 years is that. So in a way, that is exactly what's happening to us. But none of us are saying that there is going to be a civil war because of that. Even the most liberal of American politicians, even the Bernie Sanders of the world, they don't really care about the fact that, you know, we are waiting for 150 years. Why? Because we are economic migrants. Economic migrants are considered, I mean, the main thing is just then go back to your country. If you have a problem for waiting for 150 years, nobody is forcing you to stay here. So the second point that needs to be distinguished is between economic migrants, and many people who come from Bangladesh are economic migrants. They are not fleeing persecution from Bangladesh because they have the same dominant religion as those who rule Bangladesh. They are coming, or they have come here, as economic migrants. Most of them are that. So their fate cannot be conflated with those of political migrants. And every country has different processes for economic as well as political migrants. Now, there's one point about Mamata Banerjee, I think I know what she was trying to say also. The way it came out, and maybe it was her intent also to make it come out that way, was that it was almost a clarion call for war, that there's going to be a civil war. However, it is true that if you forcibly decide to evict, what will you do if there are, you know, if there are hundreds and thousands of people who have been staying at a place for 40 years, and if you say, well, we will be throwing you out at this point of time, what do you think those people are going to do? They're going to fight, of course, because, you know, people fight once they have nothing to lose. And if you're going to evict them from their house and from what they have known to be their country, you know, they do reach a point where they have nothing to lose. They're so desperate that at that point of time, there will be violence. And, you know, you can be like Game of Thrones and say, I choose violence. But no democratic government can actually follow through practically. So there are two parts of the problem. One is the principle of it. And I would be happy if politicians say, you know what, let's accept the principle. The principle is these people are here illegally. Mamata Banerjee in 2005 had a huge problem with illegal migrants from Bangladesh because at this point, those people voted for the CPM. So she was very much against them. Now she's very much for them. So let's first, so this is what I believe. Let's first at least accept that, yes, these people are illegal immigrants. They do not have rights here. However, the fact is that they're here and practically we cannot throw them out. So there needs to be some kind of compromise. There needs to be some kind of path towards citizenship for these people and a commitment to have greater border security so that this does not carry on. I think the incentive structure that at least Mamata Banerjee has is that she wants this thing to carry on because this is the way she increases her vote base. And this is not just a Mamata Banerjee thing. This was actually a CPM thing. The open borders was a CPM thing. At that point of time, this is how they increased their vote bank. Now, of course, Mamata Banerjee stands to benefit from that. So this is what needs to be stopped at this point of time. We need to have greater controls at the borders. And we also need to provide a path to citizenship. It is not practical. And again, I want to reiterate this. The difference between the principle and the practicality of it. Principle-wise, yes. The political narrative is they have every right to be there. That's what Derek O'Brien is saying. They have every right to be there. No, they don't have every right to be there. However, they are there. They have been there for a long time. And we're talking about humanity and justice. Sure, justice does consider humanity. Get them up in front of a judge. Now, also, we know that this is not possible. There's too many people. Our courts are clogged. We cannot turn our criminal courts into immigration courts. I mean, it's a problem in the US. It's a bigger problem in India. So ultimately, they will all have to be naturalized. There's no other way. But we have to make sure that all political parties come to a consensus that what has happened. We will not let this happen going forward. Because immigration isn't just a question of, and again, this is a subtle point and maybe it requires more time to explain, but the humanity of it has to be extended on all sides. There are people who are already staying in that place. And in India, we have a problem of overpopulation. So it's not as if the arrival of people is of no cost to the people who become their neighbors. It's ironic that the people who are most pro-refugees are those who have absolutely zero skin in the game. They're not going to open their house for a single refugee, by the way. They will say this in the abstract. They will sit in Calcutta and say what people in Assam should be doing. Okay. They will not do this in Calcutta, by the way. And it has happened in Calcutta. And again, what the CPM government did to actual Bangladeshi refugees is another story which we can go into another day when they actually had to deal with them, what they did to them. So those people who are shedding false tears, when refugees actually arrive at their doorstep, their behavior changes. So again, that's why I'm very careful when talking about refugees, because there are people on every side. Okay, so I'm sympathetic, but we also have to accept, summing up, the difference between illegal and legal immigration. If you do not have a right to come into this country, whether it be the US or India, people do not have a right to do that. Unfortunately, the underlying narrative is open borders. Uh-huh. It comes from classic Marxist doctrine that there are no borders. And that is something which has to be fought. The enemy is that idea. The enemy aren't the poor people who have come across the border. They are not the enemy. If you look at them, if you see what they have gone through, you will realize they're bigger victims really than anybody else. So that's really the point. And it's very difficult to kind of explain this when you write. It sometimes comes across as harsh and unfeeling. And I read about this somewhere that we have to concentrate less on being right and more on being human. And that's very important. Sometimes I also believe I make that mistake, and sometimes I compromise on my own humanity in trying to win an argument. But this is one in which I believe that you can have both. You can be human to the people who are there. However, you can also win your argument on the notion that borders are inviolable and they need to be kept that.
Quickly, on the political side of this, let's say there's a solution where we say, okay, we can make these these immigrants into citizenship. There's a path to citizenship. However, they'll be disenfranchised for 20 years. Would the people fighting for them, how do you think that this would play out? Let's say among Mamata Banerjee or among the other political parties also, now that they are no longer a vote bank.
So the fact is, this is an interesting thought experiment, but you cannot disenfranchise a citizen, because by this very definition, that person is no longer a citizen. If somebody is disenfranchised, is prevented from voting, then that person really has no say. And you really can't do that. I mean, that you can only say that in a Subramaniam Swami article, that, you know, disenfranchise people. I mean, it's a nice thing to say, perhaps, or it's a cruel thing to say, but you can't never really do that. So, not in any country, not in any country, not in any civilized country. If we want to call ourselves civilized, we cannot have a citizen who's disenfranchised. A citizen, by its very definition, has to have the right to vote. If you take away the right to vote for someone, you basically take away the only thing that defines, that distinguishes them from a cow, really. And sometimes cows are treated better than human beings. So the fact that they're allowed to vote is really the only affirmation of their humanity in this country sometimes. And that's sad to say that. So they'll have to be given the right to vote. Yes, the Mamata Banerjees of this world will benefit from it. But what's the other option? I mean, you always have to consider, what's the other option? There is no other option. Everybody is to blame for keeping open borders. Again, it's not just a West Bengal problem. Enforcing the borders is a government prerogative. So if the central government hasn't done it, well, then they need to take the blame for it too. And I'm talking about the BJP government, I'm talking about the Congress governments and the India governments which have come before. So this problem didn't happen in a day, right? It took years, decades for this problem to happen. It's just that we are at a stage where we're trying to resolve this problem. I just don't think there is a resolution to this. I also think that Mamata Banerjee shouldn't have used, if I'm being very charitable, I think this is what he was trying to say, that if you try to check them out, there will be bloodshed. But the way she said it, that was not what came out. And I think she was pretty okay with the way it came out. Because one thing, Mamata Banerjee is a great orator. She knows how to put things out. She knows why, you know, when she says something, how it will be interpreted and why. So this was not unintentional. But this came out, I mean, this basically, and she's doing this for elections. She is polarizing. In a way, when the BJP is polarizing, she's polarizing also. So this whole civil war thing is a way for her to polarize her vote bank. And that was what I felt was way out of line.
Okay. And I think before, for our final story, is something which I guess we will be following in the months to come, which is Priyanka Bitiya Ki Bidai. We spoke about it a little bit in the last episode, and much has happened since then.
Yes. Right. So I said somebody should interpret what this means for India at large, this Priyanka Chopra thing. And then I realized I have to do the interpretation. I mean, if I don't do the interpretation, who will? So for me, actually, as an avid follower of Bollywood, and not just of the movies, but of Bollywood as part of the Indian experience, it's not just making movies. It's the essence of who we are and how we perceive the world. I think this Priyanka Chopra leaving a Salman Khan movie called Bharat is really a Frodo leaving the Shire kind of moment. This is a point of no return. I mean, you don't just say no to Salman Khan and walk out. That means she's basically burnt her bridges with Bollywood, or at least with the Salman Khan camp, which is pretty significant and influential. I don't think they're going to forget this in a while. And for her, it makes perfect sense for two reasons. First of all, Hollywood, and this is when luck and fortune really come into play in your life. Hollywood is now at a stage where the biggest word is diversity. And that's why really Aishwarya Rai missed the bus. If Aishwarya Rai was, you know, in the prime of her acting, you know, prime when she was like number one at this point of time, it would be her who would be in Hollywood, I believe, other than Priyanka Chopra. But she was at a time in which she got a bit role in Pink Panther. She just missed the bus. So she was kind of like, and I have to mention Atul Bedade again. It was Atul Bedade missing the IPL bus. I mean, he would have been a billionaire if he had played in this age because of the skills that he had with hitting sixes. But he just, and before that, there was a guy called Salim Durrani, who also had this ability. He was a spinner. He was a very good fielder, and he was a huge hitter in the 70s. He was an Afghani player who used to play for India, you know, naturalized. But these guys missed the bus. So just like that, I think Aishwarya also missed the bus. And Priyanka Chopra is lucky, and good luck to her for being there at the right time. But what I really applaud her for doing is for having the courage to walk out on Salman Khan. Because for Salman, nobody says no to Salman Khan. And secondly is, in the Salman Khan movie, there are no human beings other than Salman Khan. And when he says being human, he's referring to himself. Everybody else is a prop. Everybody else is a prop that he uses to get from this part of the scene to another. So, and that's what... And that's really what the audience wants. I mean, I went to see in India that second Tiger Zindahe film, whatever that film was called, I've forgotten. Every time Salman Khan came into the on the screen, there were these groups of guys who would just shout "Bhai, Bhai," and then Katrina Kaif would come, they would shout "Bhabi, Bhabi." That's it. That was really their whole experience of the movie. And so that's really what a Salman Khan movie is. And I'm so happy that there is somebody who decided to walk out of this system and said, no, I refuse to be a prop. I will go and act with Chris Pratt and try to be an actor. Obviously, Priyanka Chopra isn't a great actor. But the fact that she has decided that she will not be a prop, I applaud her for doing that. I think it's some time somebody did that to the reigning Khans of Bollywood.
Leaving, in fact, for Shadi is one thing. Yeah, but like you said, leaving a bhai for Chris Pratt, that's a whole different thing.
Yes, exactly. Leaving Shadi would have been a very weak exit. But leaving Salman Khan for somebody who's as big, Chris Pratt is huge now in the US. So leaving Salman Khan for an American Salman Khan, of course, much better. I don't want to compare Chris Pratt to Salman Khan, but what I'm saying is going from A-list to A-list,
true.
That's the big
thing. I guess that's a wrap for this episode.
I think that's a good way to conclude. So thanks again for having me. I thought hopefully this one went better than the last episode. I'm going to look forward to more bouquets and brickbats, as they like to say. And let's see. Hopefully, we'll have a third. Third time will be the charm.
People do know where to find you. That's at GreatBong and GreatBong.net. Any other handles which you want to throw out at them?
No. These are the only official handles that I have. All the other troll handles will never be revealed. By the way, for those of you in the Bay Area, I'll be in the Bay Area on the 20th, 21st, the 22nd. My evenings are open. So we can do a live podcast. You'll be buying drinks. That's the only thing that I ask. Otherwise, if you want, we can meet up. So 20th, 21st and 22nd of this month, I'll be in Sunnyvale. And I'm saying this because I know a lot of my readers.
Let's make it happen. And you can reach out to him and please make it happen. And as for me, I'm on Twitter at @TheVikramMohan. And of course, you can reach the network at @TalkingStuffNet. Please keep the feedback coming, whether on Twitter or we've also got feedback on appodcast@talkingstuff.net. And we do realize that last time around, we were not available on all podcast platforms. We were just taking our baby steps. Hopefully now we have much better luck. So we are available on almost all places where podcasts are available, including iTunes and Google Podcasts and wherever else. So do subscribe, and we'll see you next time around. And thanks, Arnab, and see you next time.
Thanks, everyone, for listening.